Well, this is April 30th, 2004, and I'm Kara Buick here with Babette Babs Clough.
Right.
Clough. And we're at the 71st EVAC reunion in Salt Lake City. So, just start off and tell me where you were born, where you grew up.
Okay, I was born in New York City. Grew up on Long Island. Had a miserable childhood. Alcoholic parents. Major, lots of abuse. So one of my goals, I think, in getting in, it sounds crazy to get in the Army, but it was to just get away from New York and that area. And I went to nursing school with a lot of resistance from my dad. He did not want me to be in anything professional because our family, I don't even remember anybody going through college, period. So I was like one of the first to do so. And I just knew I was supposed to be a nurse. In fact, I had a vision when I was two that I was supposed to do this. As far as being in the military, I don't think the vision was quite that complete. But I knew I was supposed to do something with healing professions. And actually, I started out to be a baby nurse. And in the Army, when I finally did get in, I went into the Cadet Corps because that's the last year of your schooling. They give you, a stipend monthly, and I just didn't have any money. I'd work as a baby, I'd babysit or I'd go iron somebody's clothes or whatever so I could have tuna fish or spaghetti, because that's basically, luckily the hospital we worked in was a 3-year diploma in school, which really threw you in the trenches immediately. I mean, you were not in books, you were in books and you were in school at the same time, and you were across the street working in the hospital. So we lived and bathed this thing called, nursing. We had 19 in our class when we started. I think there were 13 left at the end of June. We had in February there were 17 classes, not credits. Everybody thinks credits, But if you count up the credits, I don't think anybody would ever do that again. I know I wouldn't. If anybody told me, I'd take that many classes. But some were coming and some were going. So we had finals and we had new ones. So the finals were like crash. You got to learn everything you can, try to pass the exams. And then the new ones had book reports and articles and publications to read and report on. And then we had at least a 4-hour stint at the hospital. And the hospital actually depended on us to be part of the staff. So even though we were carrying bedpans or giving our first shots, those poor patients, mine was in a coma, so that wasn't a bad thing. It was still servitude, literally. And there were times we had a moment that we had, R&R, so we could go to New York and see all the little goodies. But we were in Brooklyn, which is across the stream. And we watched the Barrows and Narrows Bridge built at the time I was going to school and graduated. And then when we graduated, we had to wait for our RN officially to be given, and it took until April. So I worked as a nurse from, and they knew that at the hospital because they were hoping to have us as, people that actually stayed on for years going through this nursing school. And it was the Lutheran Medical Center. So they were somewhat religiously driven as well. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of courses in religion and different kinds. So at least we got to expand a little bit of our knowledge on what was in the world, etc. And then we had the amount of time waiting for the RN so I could get into the military because I was officially a WAC. When they go in as a student nurse. And at any time, they could have yanked us over to Vietnam. We knew that. Because if they needed personnel over there, but they needed nurses more than they needed somebody that did not have, that capacity. So I lucked out and was able to wait until I got my RN and then went down to San Antonio, where most of the nursing, boot camp was.
Mm-hmm.
And did all the marching and all the learning, et cetera. And we were then assigned, and amazingly, I got assigned to Killeen, Texas, which is getting a lot of publicity right now because a lot of the people from Iraq are going from that area and actually coming back from it. They're waiting for people to come back, but I guess they canceled it recently. So we supported tank divisions, and I was in the newborn nursery of all things, and OBGYN labor delivery sections of the hospital, and I was there for 2.5 years. And then I found, I met this man, my husband currently, and we've been married this year, 37 years. We met at the hospital, and he was, I guess, one of the support, you know, administrators. And when he and I were in, I think it was Michigan, we were meeting the families. They didn't come to us, we went to them after we got married. And of course, they thought I was pregnant, but I wasn't. And I really wasn't. We were just wanting to be married. We found out that he had orders to go TDY to Fort Sam again, which was about 200 miles away from where Queen is. And so, and that MOS that they were going to send him through was supply. We knew he was a direct line to Vietnam. So we had to make the decision on our honeymoon as to what we were going to do. And my husband gave me the choice of, well, you could go back and live with my mother, or you can go to Vietnam. And I had met his mother and dad, and they were wonderful people, but I didn't think that that was going to be one of the things, especially after my horrible childhood, that I wanted to go back into a family that could be, you know, bossing me around again. And it's not that I don't mind direction, it's just, you know, it was a horrible experience. So I decided to go to Vietnam. Is that nuts or what? Because at that time, supposedly, now hearing from other people, it wasn't. It was voluntary for a nurse to go over, but some of the nurses were sucked over there. So I guess I was lucky that I got to be on mainland for a while and got some experience under my belt, really. And so then in the next few thousand, felt like months, I traveled back and forth to Fort Sam when I was off, and then my husband would come back when he was off, and that was kind of an experience all in itself, just driving back and forth. In fact, we had puppies. We had this dog, and she ended up being my mother-in-law's dog, because when we did go, we had to put her somewhere, and she had to have puppies by cesarean section because she wasn't delivering. And so I think I had 8 puppies and her that I'd drive back and forth to this, until we got them old enough, and you should have heard the screaming in the back, those little puppies, because they didn't like the idea of driving in the car. And it was a neat time. It was a stressful time because I was working 3 shifts. They would put us, bump us back to, you know, day shift, evening shift, graveyard shift, back to, you know, evening shift. I mean, you hardly even knew where you're supposed to be when at times, but, you know, you were told what to do. And he just did it. And so it's kind of good to get away from all that nightmare after we finally got the orders we were going. I was supposed to originally go for a nurse practitioner, pediatric nurse practitioner. And I don't know if I regret it or not, but I didn't go because I got married instead. We were supposed to go in August to Germany on a buddy system. And there was another lady that I was supposed to go with. And so I dropped out of the buddy system and ended up marrying my buddy for life. And that was kind of, I can say that it was good. It was a good decision. And instead we went to Vietnam in June of 68. And I got into the military, I mean full bore in 66, April. So it was a good, I think, good experience, just that part. Mm-hmm. Then we got to Vietnam, and of course we hit the ground, and I felt like crawling off the plane because it was so quiet. And they told us that there would be possibly, you know, as we're flying in, there was rumors that we might be hit. Mm-hmm. I think we were in Saigon, and whatever base, you know, it's kind of blur right now. We landed in, and the real scary part is we got in a bus, and the bus had bars on the windows. And I'm looking and I'm thinking, why in the heck do they have bars on the windows? And I had asked the bus driver, because I was just so curious, well, why is it bars in the window? They're afraid we're going to get out or somebody's going to get in. They said, no, sometimes they throw hand grenades through the windows. I thought, oh, now I'm really scared. And then we got over to where we were heading, the staging area, so to speak, and my husband and I were on the same flight, which was in itself a miracle. And they said they didn't know if we'd ever get stationed together because of the fact that, you know, they couldn't guarantee it. And yet we had been working on it for a couple months once we knew we were heading there. And they said, there's no guarantee. And we got on the plane, and there was another couple, and they had not even tried, and they were stationed together. So it was like, man, but what did we do wrong? Why didn't we get, you know, because we had worked at trying to get it. It's not like we were asking for anything. We were going to go over there and do what we were told to do. Mm-hmm. And when we were separated at the time, wherever we were in Saigon, for a couple days, and by some miracle, were put back on a plane that was heading up to the Central Highlands. When we got there, though, there was a, you know, the alarm, the air raid, what do they call it? Like you have for a fire, sirens. Yeah, the sirens started going off, and everybody started scurrying, and they go, get to the bunkers. And I'm thinking, what the heck is a bunker? I didn't remember the training in that part of it. And mm-hmm. I was like, well, I don't even know what a bunker looks like. So I just followed everybody, and we got into this, sandbagged area and sat there and shuddered for about 2 hours, and there was nothing. It was a false alarm. So it was like you just lost your everything with nothing coming in or anything. So it was kind of tense, and it was a hard start just to be in country and immediately be told that we're going to be hit. You know, I thought, geez, I just got here and they're going to kill us already. So we got on the airplane headed for Pleiku when we got our assignments, and I found out that my husband had a different assignment than I did. And that was kind of a real heart-wrenching thing. And I was young, you know, and I really wasn't that secure in my own being yet. And it was kind of nice to have a guy that was a little more secure. He had been over in the Navy, so he had served already just offshore, of course. Mm-hmm. But I think he had actually gotten onshore, and so he knew what Vietnam was like. I was surprised he wasn't shaking in his boots when he got over there. And we flew in and found out that he was stationed about 20 miles away from myself. And so he was at Camp Anari, I was at 71st Evac. And the assignment was to, you know, work on the ward as a medical surgical, you know, kind of nurse and just do what we had to do. That was because the training I had as OBGYN and newborn nursery wasn't going to apply too much in Vietnam. So I kind of worked wherever they put me. And sometimes there were times when we had three shifts, which would be 8 hours, but it was rare. Most of the time we had a 12-hour, which really bled into 16-hour because we only had, I believe we had 2 to 3 corpsmen on the floor, and we'd have maybe one nurse, sometimes two, and we'd have at least 45 patients on the floor. And we were responsible for getting them in, getting them stabilized as much as we could. Of course, the OR, the ER would stabilize them as much as they could. If there was a real big push, we would actually get shrapnel wounds, burns, and that we had to stabilize because they weren't as life-threatening as some of the other things that went through the ER. And, of course, there was triage so we could figure out which ones maybe the wards could handle. And we'd have to be pulling out shrapnel and suturing and that kind of thing, which was, something they never apply to now. You know, you go to ER, you get it taken care of there. But when you get 200 through an ER in one push, you just couldn't handle everything. So the wards were really busy. We'd have patients coming in and they'd have, if they came through ER, and most of them did, they'd have at least one IV going. A lot of times they'd have an IV and they'd have a blood port going through as well, another IV area. Sometimes they have to do a cut down, which means they actually have to suture in the IVs because they couldn't find veins. Some of them had multiple, you know, injuries. It wasn't just one thing. They'd have some few fractures. They'd have head injuries. They'd have to be stabilized by a, what they call a halo, and they completely stationary the head. And so our job there wasn't easy. And we tried to stabilize most of them. In fact, they'd have sucking chest wounds. They have just unbelievable, you know, stuff that you'd never see, I don't think, in the regular hospital over here in the Union. The other thing we saw was, of course, a lot of malaria. We saw a lot of complications of malaria, which is called black water fever, things really never would see. And then, of course, we have indigenous population. And of course, the first time we saw somebody come in, they just automatically had lice. That was just their normal thing. And couldn't speak a lick of English, so there was a bond you had to work at building to get them to understand you weren't going to hurt them, because I'm sure our image there wasn't the greatest. And we got to be friends with some of them, which I guess afterward wasn't such a good thing for them. I kept my head in the sand a little bit, not wanting to know, you know, what they did to some of the people that were supporting us.
And so your husband was stationed about 20 miles away. And
yeah.
Did you guys get to see each other?
Yeah, we saw each other infrequently. He was amazing. He was driven to get over there to make sure I knew that he was okay. We'd try to call, but they had to patch you through about four different links, almost like a ham radio or something, you know. So one would go to Saigon, and they would go up somewhere else, and they'd finally patch in, and then you get to talk, and all of a sudden it was gone. But at least we got to know each other was okay. It was a little bit difficult because sometimes we hear there was an attack on Campanari, and there were casualties coming in. And of course, my husband being over there, it's like, oh my gosh, please let me know if he comes in. You know, I'm going to be there. So that was always a big worry, and vice versa, because we'd get, you know, lobbed in on sometimes, but most of the time the stuff was coming over us because we were surrounded, except for one area. There was Engineer Hill that was way far away, and there was this huge, gigantic terrain that was open. And so they'd set up their mortars there, which was pretty stupid. I don't know how we didn't secure that perimeter, but they tried, I'm sure. And lots of times at night you would see, I think it was called Spooky, who would go through, and you could watch every 10th, and I'm probably way off on this, but 10th bullet that was going through, they could hit a football field in a matter of minutes, and every inch of it, and they'd come through and strafe that whole area. So they did some things to try to protect the hospital. Air Force was on the one side of us, the Army of Vietnam was on the other side. A little further down the road was the dust-off pilots. Further down the road was Special Forces. And so they were trying to knock off any of those, but sometimes they'd whoops and hit us. Now, unless they're mad at us, maybe they try hitting us. But most of the time we'd get to bed, you know, we'd be working that very long shift. And I think the hardest part is you'd stabilize and try to get the vacuum in 24 hours so you get more in. And in doing so, A, you couldn't get to know the folks you were really caring for. So it felt like a assembly line. You know, so a lot of the folks and the guys that came through were like blur. You couldn't really get to know their names unless they were so severe that we couldn't transport them. You know, like the chest wounds, we had to stabilize them before they could go up in a negative, you know, kind of situation on an airplane. So that was a hard one. We also lost a doctor who he thought he had the flu, and he and I had set up a theory. This was kind of hard on me, that I was going for pediatric, and that was my passion. In fact, when I had my little vision when I was a tiny little one, I was going to be a nurse, a baby nurse. That was, you know, the child's mind. But I was going to be a baby nurse. And for some reason, I was in a foster home when I was that young. And I have no idea. I still, to this day, at going to be 60, I have still no idea why I was in a foster home. And I liked it. It wasn't a bad experience for me. But the bad experience was going home to my parents. So there must have been something that went on, because my dad was a World War II veteran. And I think I was an oops that happened before he went over to the war. And anyway, getting back to being a baby nurse, there was this pediatrician that came on board, you know, came on to our unit. And he had heard that I, you know, enjoyed having the children on the ward. And we could figure out the titration, the doses of the medication and that kind of thing. We put all the blood boxes that used to come from the main room that had ice and stuff in it. So they were like styrofoam. And we cut them up and made little bassinets for the babies out of it. And it was our way of, you know, treating the children. So we had a couple of them in storage, and we were able to pull them out when we needed them. And he came over and he says, "Hey, I heard you like kids. You understand, you know, how to treat the smaller ones. Let's make this ward where we send them from the ER, because the other wards are going crazy because they get them on there and then they have no idea what to do, and I'm running around all these different wards. So why don't we just stay on your ward?" And I was excited, because it was like, yeah, that's really what I'm in nursing for, you know. Mm-hmm. And not saying that I didn't want to help the guys. I mean, I was there for whatever comes in, because when you're in nursing, humanity is your care. You know, you want to take care of whoever's put before you. So if it was a prison of war, we had at one point, we had 11 prisoners come in. And those poor guys had been beaten, maimed, and everything. One of them was dropped out of the helicopter, thrown out. We really mistreated, and we know that, and Eli and that kind of thing. You know, some of the guys were very upset, and I understand that part, big time. But I also understand these are people, and they're just, you know, philosophically different, because they've been maybe brainwashed, maybe we're brainwashed, I don't know. So anyway, when the babies came on board, there was a mutiny on the ward after a little bit. We had one little boy that had been given, I think it was chloramphenicol. He had an infection of some sort. The doctor, the Vietnamese doctor, had given him an antibiotic that had ruined his blood platelets. And he started bleeding out. And it was Christmas Eve. And I think it really took, you know, it's hard enough to be there, hard enough to be taking care of this unbelievable kind of wounds that you just wonder if they'll ever really make it back to the main room, you know, to their home. And then to have a child taking up a lot of your time. And we had one nurse that was one of the supervising nurses that had lost her boyfriend in a helicopter crash. And she was very bitter. So if there was a gook anywhere, you shouldn't be taking care of them, you should be taking care of the guys. And I don't know how many people have had that same experience, but it was heart-wrenching for me, because I was there as a humanitarian, not as political. You know, I'm going to take care of my guys, I'm going to take care of the POWs, and I'm going to take care of anybody that walks in this ward, and those people especially close to my heart, because we can make an effect on these children. See, these white people are not bad guys, or, you know, these Americans are not bad guys, they're nice guys. You know, maybe in their heart they'll know that when they grow up. So, you know, Pollyanna here. So the nurses had, I think that child put them over the edge, because he literally bled to death internally. His lips started getting to be humongous. The bruising on him was just awful. My husband came over and sat and rocked him, you know, et cetera. And it required a lot of time. And I suppose that was the straw that broke the camel's back. But because of that incident, I was called to the, it's just, again, a blur, but I was called up to the office and said that the girls did not want to have all the kids on one ward, et cetera. And what had happened to the doctor was sad, because he came in one day and he says, "You know, I feel awful." He says, "I think I've got the flu. So I'm going to go back to my hooch, and I told Dr. Da-da-da to, you know, take over my call, and he'll just kind of keep me up appraised of what's going on with the kids." And next thing I knew, he's being air-evac'd out, and he died on his way to Japan. He died of hepatitis. And he had, of course, thought he just had the flu. And it was so quick, it was just blew our minds. But it was then that the girls had like a hold on, I don't know who, but I was turned in, and that was a strike against my image that, you know, I don't know why and how they could support the, what do you call, mutiny. But that's what happened. So I lost my position as head nurse on that ward, and I ended up going to work on another ward because of that. So I feel like I was quite, I don't want to put it, ostracized, and in a way, for doing what I was told to do and what I was born to do, is to take care of whoever. So I was not given the Bronze Star that most people were given because of that incident. So I still think, you know, in fact, it's a little bit emotional for me in a way. Not that it means anything. I mean, we've got the ribbons that we got and that kind of thing. You know, when, who's going to use those? They're worthless, really. I mean, I think it was Carrie. Was it him that threw them, some of his stuff somewhere? You know, what does it mean anyway? It's in the drawer somewhere. Who knows? Sometimes I fall upon some of the ribbons we had, but it wasn't a big deal. But it was a big deal because if everybody else deserved it and we worked ourselves to death and we did nothing, I didn't do anything wrong as far as I'm concerned. And then my husband was going to get it, and he showed up for his shift, which was an 8-hour shift, and supplied the place with, you know, supplies when he finally got to us, you know, 4 months later. And yet what we were put through, you know, I don't know if medals really mean anything, but everybody else got them, and I didn't because of something that I think we were meant to do there. So because of that, I think I'm a little bitter. I also think that it was an injustice in a way, and even if they offered to me, it's, what would it mean except it would exonerate me from whatever I'm supposed to have been incorrect in doing. And I don't think it was anything. I think it was because of this one nurse that was bitter because her boyfriend was shot down and killed. And then she created the stir that, you know, the other ones kind of caught on. It's like a pack of dogs that individually they wouldn't do anything bad, but there's a pack, so they do. So that was kind of my downside of the war, as far as I'm concerned. And we did have some interesting, like we went to play coup once or twice, and if I can find it, I've got it on a reel-to-reel. So it'd be kind of interesting that if we can find someone to go from reel-to-reel to pictures, because we've got one where there was a truck that fell over, and probably the quality of the tape is pretty awful and there's no sound. But we went through play coup downtown, and of course they had never seen female white people, and actually I don't think there was any others but white people in our compound. We did have a couple of black, I think, soldiers, you know, that were supportive, like Corman. But it just shocked the Vietnamese that, you know, what tall, you know, Americans. So they kind of followed us around while we were looking into all the various shops, and of course we were warned, don't eat the public food because you'll end up with problems. And that was another issue we had. We had not only lice, but we had a lot of, all of the population seemed to be parasitic born. And I still wonder, there's different kind of parasites, the kind that are in the bowel, but there's also kinds that are flukes that are microscopic. And that could be something that a lot of us have and don't know it. And there is some parasite things which I can get to in a minute. But anyway, we went and went to a couple of different areas. Like we got to see the lake that supplied us with the water. I forget the name of the lake. In fact, for a while they even had like a motorboat. And we had heard, we didn't do it, but there were some folks that were water skiing on the lake. And what was a shock to me was the hospital and how wonderful it was. I mean, it was structurally very sound. We had grass. We had, you know, ditches where the water would flow through. Whoever engineered it was very thoughtful in the way they put it together. We had a swimming pool that was put in just before we got there. And we were there 68, 69. And we were thankful for that. I mean, it was like a little bit of normalcy in a way instead of just completely like I saw on the shore, there was just basic nothing. I mean, there was a beach. Cameron Bay was pretty, but it was also, when we were going flying through there for R&R or for leave, we went to Hong Kong. We just wanted a little bit of the world because we felt like we were camping out for for how long, you know. In fact, they finally put an officers' club in while we were there and had such a thing, and they'd have hamburgers at least. But I guess we were just talking down at breakfast, and they said there was some bootlegging of our food. So there was one week I remember hot dogs every single day. And we thought, there's got to be another place we could eat. And so we went over to the Air Force, and they always had steak and lobster and all kinds of wonderful things. And that was just a drive away. We weren't allowed to drive anything. We had to have a driver and request a truck, but we most of the time could dig something up. And one night, this was great, went down to the Special Forces, because they had pizza. They actually made pizza, but it was like Chef Boyardee pizza. Mm-hmm. At least it was pizza. Mm-hmm. So we went down to get a number of people pizza, and my husband and I went, and there was this other wonderful little driver that gave us total respect. I mean, the guy was just incredible. He says, "I'll be right here waiting for you." So he parked the Jeep outside of the compound because he wasn't allowed to drive into the compound. And we walked in, ordered the pizza, and then all of a sudden the alert goes off, and they said, "You got to get out of here now. We can't have dead personnel on our that don't belong here." So I'm thinking, why in the heck is that the rule? You know, that sounds nuts. But they were actually, there was like the Special Forces were there, and there's a field over on the other across the street, mm-hmm. and there was mortars flying in, hitting the ground, and we thought anytime they're going to hit us, and we thought the Jeep would be gone. I thought he'd be back at the compound. He was sitting there waiting for us. I mean, shaking and glued to the steering wheel while we flew in, and it looked just like a war, period. I mean, it showed us what it, you know, we were really in the midst of a war. Because most of the time when we heard the mortars, we were under our beds. Or maybe we were in the ward and trying to secure the patients. But we generally didn't have it as bad as some of the other locations, like Kuchi. I had another girlfriend there, and they were always having to take the patients. Sometimes they were so severe they put mattresses on top of them, mm-hmm. to keep their lines in. So that was one of our exciting evenings. Another one was we went over to a, it was called, I think, Transportation Division, and I think they had something to do, and I could be confused, but we went over to another club so we could eat somewhere else, you know, because we were always looking for something that, you know, if you look up our pictures, we're pretty skinny. But most of the stuff, it was terrible food. Just, you know, one guy was mad at us one time and put pepper in our Jell-O. Oh, great. Well, this is good. And then the milk was filled milk, and I have no idea what it really was, but it was pretty gross tasting. But we went over there, and then we came back, and one of our friends, in fact, she's here, I won't mention her name, got really looped, and we're having to hold her in because she was taking up the whole back seat, throwing, I guess she said it was paper plates, I thought it was toilet paper, and she was throwing it out the thing. I said, "They're going to find us, they're going to know where we go because you keep leaving a trail." So that was fun. But we had a volleyball court, which we used about halfway through. Of all things, we just, and I, to this day, I just love my washing machine because we had the mamasans washing our clothes, which was nice because then we didn't have to spend our one day off, if we even got it, washing and housekeeping. They would come in and do most of that. Some of the people let them clean their rooms too. We didn't do that because my husband and I got, when he finally came over four months later, we got two rooms, and we busted a wall between the two rooms, used the two beds, and made a king-size bed out of it, and it was a lot more comfortable than a twin when you're sleeping with somebody that's 6'4". In fact, the first jury rig we did a spring with a blow-up mattress to extend on the twin bed, so at least we could sort of have a decent night's sleep before they started mortaring us. And he'd end up about hanging on the string in the morning, you know, you see him about halfway down the bed, hanging on the string, and I'd have to yank him up. So that was quite a time. And we had our first anniversary there in August. We had been married August 4th. So the hooch, I think that was just before he came over, made a cake, an anniversary cake. And it was made in one of those fry pans, mm-hmm. the electric fry pans. Mm-hmm. Never knew you could make a cake in a fry pan, but they did it. It was amazing. And so we started gathering things. In fact, when we went to Hong Kong, we brought back bags. In fact, we had them shipped to ourselves. We went grocery shopping in Hong Kong and got all these cans of stuff. I'm not sure who got our hooch afterward, but we had painted it blue instead of the, you know, whatever the wall colors were at the time, so it made it a little like home. And, you know, his mother used to send us a whole bunch of stuff from home, too. So we left quite a legacy, I'm sure, when we left, because we still had plenty of storage. I think to this day we're like that. There's a storage of stuff everywhere. So there's more of it. Do you have any questions?
How do you think you were treated in the Army as a woman? Did you find any stigma, or... I mean, even before you left, what did people think?
Yeah, the one thing that was kind of interesting, well, because you're an officer, so I thought I was treated well. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of times the guards, the MPs at the gate that wouldn't salute us, they'd turn around and scratch their nose or something and wave us through or whatever. That might be the only thing. Other than that, I think we were treated with a lot of respect. I didn't have any difficulty with that. In fact, a lot of times they would actually take a second look because they weren't used to seeing women officers. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was a positive experience, mm-hmm. not a negative, except for the ones that were couldn't understand why a woman would have a rank. You know, mm-hmm. So in those days, I think that was, you know, it was a mixed bag.
Was that something that drew you to the Army, that you could be an officer? Or why did you join the Nurse Corps?
I went and looked at the Navy, because I was going to be a Navy nurse. I didn't, this is crazy, but I didn't like the uniforms. Mm-hmm. And then I did go through, and I don't remember the facility, but I went through a facility in Long Island, and I decided I was going to be doing paperwork only, and the corpsman did most of the nursing. And I was I am a hands-on person, not somebody that likes to do paperwork, because I'm quite dyslexic, now I find out. I mean, the worst part of our Vietnam experience was the charting. You know, I could take care of the IVs, make sure they were as in order as we could. We didn't have any pumps like they have now that can meter how much is going in, but and it was nuts. I mean, if they bent their arm, they would stop. And the supervisor would come in and yell at you because the IV's not on time. I'm thinking, at least the IV's in. You know, don't give me trouble for that. Mm-hmm. So the paperwork was always a problem for me because of my dyslexia, I think. And so when I found out the Navy nurses, that's mainly what they were, supervisors, I didn't want that. So I looked around and I liked the uniforms of the Army. And so that was what drew me. The Air Force required a bachelor's in nursing, and that would have meant, which is stupid now, but would have meant another year before I could get in. And I'd have to go through more schooling. And with my dyslexia, I was happy to have B's and C's, and I got A in physics. So I really wasn't, you know, wanting to be any more into the trenches. Like, you know, as far as scholastically, I just wanted to get my hands on and help people. So that's why the Army finally was the only other that I knew of. Maybe I could have done some other things now that I think, you know, of all the other things that are available. And I did like it. I thought being an officer was much better than being a specialist, first class, or whatever, private first class, that's what it was.
Had you thought about civilian nursing at all?
What's civilian?
Just working in a hospital in the United States.
Well, the reason I didn't was because I needed the money. So the Marine Corps had offered the cadet program, which would help me get through the rest of school. As I said, my dad did not want me in nursing school. My mother was wonderful because she, in her, that way, she was able to help me get a loan. I don't know how she was able to do it, but I think she had a job in some kind of a fiberglass place or whatever. She has subsequently died of heart failure, but she had other, you know, health issues, but I think that was one of her contributors. Plus, she smoked like a fiend, too. And I'm sure her hurt her lungs quite a lot. So, heart-lung relationship. But she was the one that kept me on course. Well, I kept myself on course, but she was the one that I kept nudging, and she was the one that would bend for me. My dad said, well, you're just going to, you know, if you get it, you're just going to get pregnant and be at home anyway. Because that was his, he's Italian, and that was their way of doing it. My aunt never left the house. My, you know, everything in the Italian thinking is that you just have children and you stay at home. So that was a little different than what I had envisioned in my life. So somehow I got it, and because of my mom. But I still, they didn't have a lot of money, and so I had to somehow be creative, and the Corps was the best for me. Plus, I wanted to get out of New York. I didn't want to stay there. I had this vision of having a, and I finally did, a mailbox at the end of a long driveway with critters, and horses especially, and I think the only way I could do that is to get out of New York. Because, of course, I didn't realize upstate was as beautiful as it was. I could have probably somehow figured a way to go work up there. But working in the, you know, straight hospitals wasn't alluring anymore to me. And I didn't know what I wanted, really. And I think the good Lord just kind of threw me exactly where I needed to be. Because I love Texas. I was just amazed. I got down there and was like, wow. I leased a horse. I got to ride. I had a really good friend, Susan Bork. And she has subsequently died. She was over in Cucci. But she got married and then went over a little later. But I'm surprised she wasn't killed, because that was a horrible place to have to be, from what I hear. They were in worse, they were more intense, where we had Uchis, which is more structurally doing something. You know, when it rained, you can have the tent collapse on you or something. So, and I love Pleiku. Pleiku, I did get to see some of the coastal places that they worked, and I thought we had one of the best units, you know, that I could have chosen. Like I said, I just felt like, wow, the good Lord's taking care of me. You know, I've got plenty of good angels running around protecting me. And there were times when we thought this is the end, or we might have to be evacuated ourselves, you know, and I kept thinking, well, what are we going to do with the patients? We have so many patients, you know, they have to evacuate. And I would think we were like the captain on the ships. They would want to get us out last, you know, get those patients out first. So, anyway, that was how I got in the military. Just because it was financially much more sound. I just didn't want to stay in Brooklyn the rest of my life, which is what it would have been otherwise, I think.
Did you talk to a recruiter, or did you just go and sign up and on your own? Did that person come to your school and talk about it? Do you remember that at all?
I went down. I went to a recruiter, and I looked at my options a little bit. And as I said, I had looked. I was pursuing it because, you know, it was either Navy or that. And I had some friends that had boyfriends that were up in the academy. It's upstate New York, and I forget which academy now. 37 years ago, or 38 years ago. It was a long time to remember all these details. A couple of them actually married at the academy. Some of the guys, and so they just went to civilian life, became wives of the officers. And I thought, heck, I could become an officer without going to that academy. And it's had a lot of publicity lately, too, on how they're treating women. So, I don't know. Not the Navy, yeah. Anyway, I think it was a Naval Academy.
Did you? What was your husband's rank?
I always outranked him. I was, I think about 6 months ahead because they were advancing this pretty quickly because of the people, attrition, who were going out. So when I met him, he was a second lieutenant. I was a first lieutenant. And then I got my captain bars, and he got his first lieutenant. And then I think he got his captain bars over at the hospital where we were in Vietnam.
Was that ever an issue or even a joke?
It was a joke. He says she always outranks me, and now she's a civilian. Now she really outranks me when he was still in. And then the part that I really wanted to get to, you know, in the interview was the medical part. Because I really feel the Agent Orange has played a very heavy role in my health. And, of course, I was alerted to that only in 81. But up until then, I had had chronic... I mean, I was operated on in Vietnam on my right nostril to open up the passage because I couldn't breathe. And my allergies were just horrific. I had sinus infections a lot. I had chronic bronchitis. There was a big push, of course. It was quiet, deader than a doornail, so the one doc had said, well, why don't we do some surgery on your nose? It's a pretty minor surgery. Of course, I almost died from the anesthesia. I couldn't breathe. My lungs had locked up. And the push had happened, so I told him, I'll leave. I'll go back to my hooch. And luckily, my husband was a little bit on the flexible side for the way he operated. He had, you know, because he was a supply officer, he could have some of the folks working with him keep him appraised, and he stayed with me 24/7 until, you know, I started coming out of it. But I actually thought I was going to die, not from being shot or hit by a mortar, but because of the anesthesia. And they have checked me for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and at first they said I had it, and lately, because of my herbal direction, I've actually changed in the way I think about, you know, the body, and have gone into other directions just because I felt like I wasn't getting any answers in the traditional Western medical philosophy. And I had spinal arthritis. Got to a point where my husband used to have to pull me out of bed, and he was the healthy one. I lost my first baby. I lost two other pregnancies. Come to find out, another lady that I was in the unit with, she also lost her first pregnancy. They said it was a possible folic acid deficiency. We do know folic acid is a big thing now. But I have a suspicion that it is Agent Orange, considering my husband and I both being over there. We both had, you know, terrific exposure, from what I understand. You know, we didn't actually go bathe under the spray or anything, but the folks came in with it on their outfits and that kind of thing, and apparently it's quite easy to get. So, dioxins of all kinds. I remember going to the mess hall one morning, and there was a guy spraying right there, and the mist was hitting us, and that was malathion. He said he was spraying for mosquitoes, to keep the mosquitoes down because of the malaria scare. And, of course, the malaria pills made us really ill as well. So we were walking around half there because we were so sick from the whatevers, not realizing eventually it's going to pay more of a toll on our life. I forget when I actually stopped. I actually had no voice. As of, I know, 93, I could not talk. I was evaluated finally in Minnesota at the VA hospital there because I was wandering all over the country at that point. We had been in Michigan for 11 years. We went to Reno for 5. Then we went to Hawaii for from 86 to 93. And then was seen periodically at the VA. And by the way, I think the women anyway are treated very well at the VA. That part I have to say thank you for, because I've heard other stories from the guys, though, that they haven't. You know, so I'm kind of disappointed that, you know, in a way we were singled out and the chosen one, so to speak, which is nice, but it's not nice for the guys. Anyway, they said there was a nodule. They said if they would do any work on it, they could cause me never to have a voice. So I said, well, I'll leave it there and I'll just try to do it my way. And so literally, it's been a journey getting my voice back. So just to speak today is an honor. Not to have pain in my back is a miracle. And I used to have chronic headaches. I mean, I could probably identify five different kinds of headaches that I'd have, and it was very difficult to get up in the morning. But I ended up having three live births. The first one used to have ear infections chronically, and they'd never seen it so bad. They said that she was like a chrome above having a bubble. Her immune system was so bad. The next one had asthma, and very, very severe. We almost lost her a couple times. In fact, my first one was spent her first birthday in the hospital with a sinus infection, and oh, by the way, she also has pneumonia. And so she really suffered. They had to do like quarter doses of immunizations on her because they couldn't. We never had a well day with her, and she was hyperactive. I told my mother-in-law once, "Do you ever die of exhaustion?" And I thank God I lived near her. She was a great model for me as far as how to be a mother. She was a really wonderful lady, and she took over where I could go take a nap. So a lot of times I'd go over to her house just to get a nap and sleep for 4 hours. That wasn't a nap, it was a nice sleep. The second one was born 4 years later, and she was like an angel. Although her respiratory stuff didn't start till a little bit later. But she started showing some problems as well. I was worried about her, and we did almost lose her a couple times, but I was more worried, sounds crazy, about the older one because she was so hyperactive and with these ear infections that the doctors kept saying, I've never seen anything like this. And she had six sets of ear tubes. She had twice a tympanoplasty, a brand new eardrum put on, and she has a huge mastoid bone hypertrophy, meaning it's swollen back there all the time. And everybody kind of dismisses it, but oh no, that's not normal. If you look at everybody's mastoid bone, you don't see that. And my last one had leukemia. He was born with a high fever. We were in the hospital for 8 days. They couldn't identify what the problem was. Went home, and at age three, this one doctor finally said, I think there's something really wrong. This guy has high white counts, but not high enough yet for us to treat, but he's got leukemia. And he's on his way to, you know, life-threatening kind of situation. And my advice, and she was not going to stay very long. She was in Kaiser system. She says, I would find an alternative way to do this because all three of the kids is strange in your situation. At least she looked at us as a whole because everybody was looking at us individually. And all I did was spend time. Thank God my husband had a fairly good job. And his health wasn't too bad at the time. Now he's falling apart. We went to different people. Nobody identified it as Agent Orange. I identified it as Agent Orange. And I'm sure possibly it's because of compensation, et cetera. I just want answers. I'm not looking at the compensation part. I'm looking at what can we do for these kids. And I'm sure it's throughout our whole, I would like this weekend, in fact, it should be throughout the whole hospital. There should be some identifiable common ground. A lot of these kids. And, you know, maybe because my husband and I both were exposed, there's going to be a larger incident in our family than there would be, and maybe half of the kids wouldn't be mm-hmm. troubled because the father was not, or the mother, well, I mean, this is Vietnam nursing, so it would be the father we'd be looking at. So I'd kind of almost like to have, or be part of a study. It's a little more than just the neural tube issue, because they were saying if you had somebody, you know, anencephalic, well, you wouldn't have a child without a brain, you know, or spina bifida. That was the other one that was studied and said that is directly related. Now they're starting to say it in laryngeal cancer. I started working with alternative doctors. As I said, I've been led to the different doctors now that I've had the honor of working for. And one group, and I'm back to working with them. I worked between 84 and 86. I'm now working with one of them that's an alternative cancer doctor. And he's worldwide. In fact, you can look it up on the internet. It's drbrodie.com, B-R-O-D-I-E. And his philosophy on how cancer actually happens in the body. And it's not a one thing. I mean, you can have a viral, you can have a chemical. So the chemical is a stimulant to produce cancer. And I just heard at breakfast a couple of folks that have gone from cancer. Now, it's not just going to be one kind of cancer or the kind they're identifying as a cancer. If you have lung cancer, and I had lung problems, I mean, severe lung problems. I've had five pneumonias, you know, that they can identify, and asthma that I've got under control because of herbs. I don't take as much as I can. I stay away from any medication. If you come look in my room, you'll see herbs all over the place. And I'm a walking herb because it works for me. You know, and I think I can direct people to the kinds of things that can keep their body at least functioning at an optimal level compared to the way I operated before. I mean, I couldn't even take medication. If I took pain medication for my arthritic back and my arthritic hands, I'd be vomiting. And I have worse headaches because the medication would cause the more, you know, even more intense. They were so crushing, I thought I was having strokes. So, you know, would you do that? Not me. Not anymore. So I'm not one for aiming for the drug direction. And now I'm watching what I call miracles. My son, we were delivered in this doctor's office that was doing electrodermal type of screening. And it's kind of an energy medicine, but it actually measures the acupuncture points of the hands and the feet. And so you have, like taking your car in to get your oscilloscope checked, you have a way of monitoring the body and see which systems are screwed up or off. And after you determine them, what kinds of things, be it herbs or homeopathics, then you could actually put in medication too, would help stabilize that meridian. So it, A, would not be freaking out. B, maybe drain it. Because I think the liver is probably the largest stressor in the whole body. So the liver has to be cleared somehow of, and the chemicals, you know, being Agent Orange. And then once your immune system drops, anything else that jumps in. So you'll have virals, you'll have fungals, and there is a theory of pleomorphic changes, which means this cell, that's supposedly a normal cell, will change into a virus, which then will morph again and change into a fungal. And then the fungals can change into the cancer cell. Very fascinating. And it's, I mean, we're doing so many things in medicine right now that is so new and cutting edge, and everybody's poo-pooing it. But it's starting to become general knowledge, like the stem cell research, coming from your own nasal passage to make a implant on a spinal cord and create healing. I mean, we have things that are coming right now that are so exciting, it's almost like you want to hold on so you don't float away. So we have ways, I think, that we're going to be able to help what we're finding. It's not just get data. Let's do something about this thing. So today I sit here and my back doesn't hurt. My hands work. No problem. I look, I don't think I look 60. Maybe I do, but my one girlfriend just told me I look like, you know, on my pictures that you see in the thing. You can identify who I am. Where some of them, I looked at them and was like, who are you? I don't know who you are. So I practice what I've been researching. And I'm very fortunate to be in a clinic that is looking at anti-aging as well as these really disastrous chronic diseases that we have no answers for. And to me, you know, I went on and got more training. And what really cleared my head and actually changed my dyslexia to a moderate instead of severe, maybe even mild, was I went through acupuncture oriental medicine training. So I've got my bachelor's and master's, which I never would have thought of. When I got out of nursing school, that was it. I was never going back to school. And to have the treatment I had and then to be able to have the clarity of mind is like a miracle. It really is. And there are things I've watched that have been told, you have lupus, you're dead. You don't have any, you know, you've got to stay on the steroids and get all the chronic diseases that that causes, like kidney shutdown, osteoporosis, all the horror things. Look at poor Jerry Lewis and what he looks like now compared to what he looked like before. So there are ways around this other than drug people to death. And I think the understanding of our science background has been what's led me to the next step. That's sort of too cut and dry in a way. The herbs have been here forever. the Chinese having a 5,000-year track record of just observing. They didn't have much to do. They didn't have computers and TVs, so they had to do something, just observe. And what they've observed is just unbelievable if we just listen to the old ways. One of the other things I did was went to a medicine man, a Indian medicine man, that helped me a lot with my voice. And then one other real interesting methodology of changing the energy patterns in the body. And it all sounded like spooky, weird, foo-foo stuff, you know, too far out there. But when it actually affects you and the health of all your family, you got to start sitting up and looking at it and saying, okay, then how can I tell other people? And I think one of the things I was here just to observe in a way this time, I hope we have another reunion so that we can get, you know, once I, like you're gathering data, I need somebody that would be willing to do a research project, and I'd like to help coordinate it or assist it or contribute to it or something. You know, I don't have to run the thing. I don't really have time anyway. Because I've got now a practice that people come see me because I've learned how to do the electrodermal screen, check the systems that are out, and help them correct them. And I've got plenty of people that would tell you that I've saved their life more than once. And it's only because someone saved mine. And I'm walking and thinking and getting up in the morning. And before I could sleep till noon, 2 o'clock, and I could probably sleep 24 hours a day. What a waste of a life. And now I can get up in the morning without the alarm. You know, to me that's like, wow. People do that.
Uh-huh.
Never would have thought that before. So, anyway, that's my mission, I think, now. And I've got a very active practice. I had over 5,000 patients in Hawaii. I feel bad I'm not there now, but there are other practitioners, and at least the door's been open for them, so they know there's another way. I think I want people to understand there's another door, and they can go through that one. They might regain some of their function or some of their health through that door. It doesn't mean it's going to cure, because I don't believe that there's a cure. I think that you can live with whatever it is. You know, there's so many heads to this, and there's so many dimensions to this wellness that we all.
Well, so you've done all of this since you've been back, so you've been pretty busy since Vietnam.
Yeah, actually, you know, today I sit here saying, man, I'm tired. I also went and got my homeopathic credentials, and that's, so I've actually had 12 more years of schooling. And I'm a doctoral candidate for acupuncture and herbal medicine, but I'm not going to pursue it. I might try to get something in the line. I'm actually a doctor of divinity because I felt that my spiritual background, even from tiny, has been driving me to do whatever I'm doing. And I do it from my heart and from whoever, you know, you call your creator. I really feel I'm driven from that source, and I feel it's it's my job here on the earth. So, some people I've just talked to, they're retired, and I'm thinking, retired? Is that even in my vocabulary? That would be nice. I'd probably handle it for 2 weeks, but I have to do what I'm here to do, and you know, maybe it'll take me earlier because I'm so doggone stressed and busy. But to have somebody hurting or just to have somebody needing the kind of therapies we give. I couldn't stay home and knit. It just couldn't be my lifestyle because it's so exciting. I mean, I feel like we're just on the brink of new information and new things that we can stop some suffering. If we can, that's what we're here to do, or I'm here to do anyway. My doctor that I'm working for is just turned 79 2 days ago, so he's my hero. I mean, he's still going 90 miles an hour and trying to help people that have cancer, and be it first stage or last stage, he makes it comfortable for them. If they are in the last stages, we don't ever say we can cure them. But I have seen both sides, you know, being in nursing. You see the ones that go through the chemo and die a horrible death. I mean, it's something I never want to experience myself, so why would I want to watch someone else? So if there's anybody that would listen, I would like to get them in this direction. And I say cancer because I think a lot of the Agent Orange, even from what I'm hearing, that's the end of how a lot of them go. So how do we stop this? At least make them comfortable while they're going, because we're all terminal. We're all going to die. It doesn't matter your age, you're all going to die. But how bad is it going to be when you die? So that's one of my missions, and I don't know how I'm going to be able to. I need help. That's, I guess, one of the things maybe I'm here for, is say, I need help trying to figure out how to pass the word on and put a protocol together, if anybody will listen, for them to at least do minor things to make their quality of life good until the day they don't get up. You know, that would be the way I'd want to go. I want to just not get up in the morning. You know, go to sleep and that's it. Isn't that the way most of us want it? Or have a car accident, which I don't think. I'd like to say I'm a good driver. It's the other guy I worry about.
Do you involved in veterans activities at all?
You know, I got a little bit involved in Vegas, and I gave some talks on, for instance, to the blind veterans. I just have spoken, you know, to different organizations, just to make them aware again that there's another way. And through that, I have been able to help some veterans. In fact, I just recently had one that he is on the kidney transplant list. And I found out, I don't know how he found me, but people find me because they're supposed to find me. And his kidneys were shutting down. He was supposed to get kidney dialysis. And he lived so darn far away from the Veterans Hospital that they had just bought a place retired and had 20 acres, and they were just loving it. Now he's going to have to move back to the, you know, close into the town that he didn't really want to live. And I think he's about 120 miles away from the Veterans Hospital. And so I started him on a program, and his kidneys today are working. He's off the transplant list, and he is having a life again. He's actually off the couch. I mean, the poor guy would sleep 24/7 if he could. He knew he didn't want to, but he had to. So those are the kinds of things that I'm trying to do little by little. It does cost money. That's the problem. And a lot of folks don't have, because the insurance, it's really medicine by insurance now. It's not any other way. If the insurance company says it's okay that you can have a drug that could, you know, take you out of pain, supposedly, or, you know, they don't know what it'll do, they'll pay for it anyway. But if it's some kind of alternative, they call it, I call it complementary, because you work two at the same time and just augment the therapies. I think you can make a better life, but the insurance companies won't let them. So the only way I can see a way out of this is having your own funds, put it into your own bank account, building interest like they do with your money, because a lot of times they deny anything to send in anyway. So it's like, would you please let me get treatment I think is going to work for me? You know, and has been proven. It's not like this is an unproven therapies now that we're doing. I mean, echinacea is a common household word now. When I first got into the trenches, as I call it, in 81, they thought you were some kind of witch doctor or something. And now they find, hey, that might even help not get this cold. Let's get that on board. Vitamin C, you know. Mm-hmm. Might even do some good. Zinc. Take some zinc lozenges and your sore throat might not be as severe. It might not take it away, but it might not be as severe. So I think the education part was the part I was after. Since I've arrived in Reno, which I just recently did, a couple of years ago now, it feels like recent, we've had to move once because the office I was in had mold. Didn't realize it. And my office, of course, had to... It's like God just gives me these experiences so I can figure out how to fix them. I ended up with mold in last April, almost died of encephalitis and pancreatitis because it hit me so heavy. And mold is a real big issue swept under the rug here in the United States, because you try to get mold insurance on your house, you can't. You can have water damage, but you can't get mold insurance because they know it's so pervasive throughout. In fact, you live in Hawaii, you might as well just count it in as part of your terrain. Having that experience now, I've got on board in my brain what to do for that, which is another piece of the puzzle I think a lot of people are suffering from. So you're saying allergies. Most of us have In fact, Mayo Clinic has just come out. We have fungal right here. We have to figure out how to control the fungal in the sinus area, and then it won't pervade the rest of the body. So a lot of our allergies are caused by that. And there are some cleanses and that kind of thing that I've researched and gathered as part of my toolbox. And it's not my idea. It's like, just like you're doing, you're gathering information. And I've gathered information from various people, and anybody in this kind of job that I'm doing, I think, has that search engine, so to speak, trying to look for all the things that are going to be valuable, you know, for whatever case might be. Thank God for the internet. I think that's why medicine is going to advance so fast. And nobody's, you know, if something comes up with an idea, it's not being hidden. Where before you could, you know, pretty well tuck it under the rug and nobody's going to know about this anymore. Because there wasn't a lot of communication, but the internet's going to be our savior.
Did you ever, when you were diagnosed with PTSD, or did you ever have problems like someone
had? No, I don't think I have had it because of my husband. We have been able to talk if something comes up, you know, of our experience there, et cetera. Talking about it has, I think, basically helped. We really haven't gone in, and we probably should, but I don't think we've stabilized long enough in one place without so much stress going on in our lives, besides having the children that are so ill. There wasn't a moment to even worry about that, you know. But functionally, you know, we were able to function as a couple, and that's probably what saved us from that. If you go back to my assault by the, you know, mutiny on the ward, I could say I probably should work that one out, because it does still get an emotional part of me out. But in a way, it's common sense that I was accused of something that I shouldn't have been accused of. You know, so I think that would be the only thing I probably should work out. But honestly, we haven't had time. And now my husband, it's kind of interesting, I'm feeling better. I don't feel like top of the heap, ready to go exercise every day and that kind of thing, although we have animals, and I have gotten back to my horses and stuff. And even though I'm 60, I have another friend who's almost 80, and she rounds horses up and she brands them and everything else. So I said, you know, if she can do that, I can do what I want to do, too. Uh-huh. And we're milking goats now. We've got our own little goat factory going, and we've got chickens that lay eggs and stuff. And that fills my soul. I mean, that, to me, is an event. If you want to talk about getting back to my dream, making my heart sing, if I'm out in nature and I'm out with the animals, that takes away any pain that I've got emotionally. And they're my healers, so to speak. So, and having the research bend in my brain to try to help what I'm trying to help, I don't have time to worry about my emotions, and maybe I should stop for a minute and figure that out. I don't know. But I think I'm a pretty stable, caring, loving, functional part of society. My husband, on the other hand, I think he's gotten into it. And I don't think he realized it. But as we speak this weekend, he's putting through a disability thing because he can't hold a job, and he has severe headaches. Now he's got the headaches, and we just did an MRI and they didn't find anything. I said, no brains either? No, but he does have he's an intelligent, brilliant man. I mean, they've said he's a genius, but the poor guy is dyslexic also. So it's been very, very difficult for him, although he does, as I said, writes, and he's done some emotional things. He's gotten through, he knows how to get hypnotherapy, and he does it beautifully. He has been trained in NLP, neurolinguistic program. And it does help. For instance, if there is a past experience someone had, he can actually bring them back to that day and say, somebody assaulted you, you know, swiped your purse. And from then on, you might have a phobia. It may not be related to that at all. But he can actually disconnect that phobia once he goes back, even 2 minutes before the purse was snatched, and have you look at the world from that moment perspective, and then put all the new sticky notes up, because you put a whole bunch of nasty sticky notes because of that assault. So it's kind of a neat thing, but for him, he's been battling, and it's a gift he's got. He's been battling to try to get people to even want that kind of therapy. And he's done radio shows and that kind of thing. And I'm doing radio shows too. I've got two coming up. I think there's one this Thursday to just expose people again to homeopathy and they're complementary. I don't want to say alternative because that means you don't do the other one. Because I like looking at lab work because it changes. If you do the right work, you actually change the way the body functions and the way the body can clear things, and all of a sudden cholesterol drops. My cholesterol used to run about 300. I've got it down to 189 without the drugs. And of course they were at VA trying to push the drugs on me, and I see in our clinic cancer patients coming through, and one of their drugs, and they have it in the liver, is Lipitor. So you can't even get me near Lipitor. I see a pill and I want to run because that stuff is dangerous. And it is a side effect. It says it right on it. And I'm seeing the aftermath of it. So the kind of work I'm doing is fascinating. It's saved my life as far as I'm concerned. And now I am working on my husband. It's a little hard when your own husband's doctor. It really is. He'll not listen to me on diet. He'll not listen to me on a lot of the things that he needs to change. So it's his experience, too. I think that's the other thing. I'm not going to take anything I know and shove it down anybody's throat. I want people to find a point at which they say, man, I need something different. What I'm doing doesn't work. So what is there? You know, can I educate two people? Maybe they can go out and educate two more. And then the world starts knowing, you know, there is another alternative. There is something else I can do to add to what I'm doing. You know, I still would like an MRI. I want a PET scan to see what the body's doing. I'd like to have a urine analysis if the bladder kidney is a problem. I was aerodactyled back from Vietnam because of a kidney problem. So I was medevaced home. And my husband somehow got to accompany me. So that's how he got out, because he was supposedly leaving 10 days after I was leaving. And so we were able to work it out that he was able to be my medical assistant, or I don't know how they put a term kit. Uh-huh. But it was so screwy the way they were manipulating that you're out of there. So, and luckily my kidneys have done very well. They didn't do for a long time, but they did. They're fine now. You know, I still kiss the ground that I know what I know. And I'm hoping other people will listen.
What do you think was the best part of your year there? Or just the whole experience of things, you know?
Yeah, it sounds crazy, but I thought I was so blessed. I mean, I did go see some other units because of our in and out, just when we left for R&R or coming up, where we had to come up through. I think we went through Nutrang, and I thought, oh my God, this is awful. It was so hot. So humid, it was almost you couldn't breathe. Then we got up to the Central Highlands where we were, and it was like, oh my gosh, it's cooler up here. We even had a winter. We had like 40 degrees, and we didn't have heaters. We didn't have, all we had is a flap on the window, so you could open the flap or close it, and then you had screens. And that was it. And of course, we had, which was a laugh, they'd come through and do white glove inspection. And if you were lucky enough to have the helicopter not land before they inspected, you could have a white glove inspection. But as soon as the helicopter landed there, you could swipe and find dust, of course. So, and the good experience was that, you know, we were officers. We were treated, I think, very well. I was kind of out of the party group. I never drank very much. If I drank, I got so sick that I just couldn't drink. So that wasn't one of my thrusts. I didn't smoke. So I wasn't in the in crowd at the officers' club. We'd go in and have a hamburger and go home. You know, that was, it wasn't a disappointment to me, but I felt like an outsider in a way because I wasn't a party animal. And I was married. And I had no interest in not being married. You know, there were some that were together that were married, but their spouses were back in the mainland. so it was all kinds of hanky-panky going on. It was kind of fun to sit in the, I think, in the bleachers and watch all the crazy MASH. I mean, when we watched MASH, it was like, did somebody actually take scripts from our lives in Vietnam? This is exactly what was going on. You know, it was kind of, when we first drove in, the commanding officer's hooch had a bra hanging in its... and he's supposedly a commanding officer. I thought, oh boy, what are we getting ourselves into?
Uh-huh.
So we kept pretty isolated in a way, and I think I was really naive. I still am about a lot of the happenings in, you know, in the unit. I didn't even know how many people were actually stationed there. I think around 200, but I'm probably way off, and I don't know them all. Well, we just didn't have a lot of relationship, because when you work 16 hours, there's not a lot of time to socialize. And you couldn't socialize with the enlisted. You know, you're an officer, you're not allowed to touch them. You know, stay away from them. So we really couldn't get too friendly, although one sergeant was just the most amazing guy. His name is Sergeant Cheryl. I didn't even know his first name. But he was just like my backbone on the ward. So that was a very peaceful time. We got... we always got like the best ward, you know, that at that time or that week or whenever they're doing their inspections, which I thought was idiotic. But, you know, to have people making sure that things were happening on the ward correctly is right. But to have white glove inspection in the middle of a war zone when they have helicopters landing doesn't make too much sense to me, but that's the military, I suppose. Those poor people in Iraq wonder how they even keep their engines clean. You know, never mind keep their... bodies together. Another Vietnam, as far as I'm concerned. So it was a good time. I'm glad I had the experience of being in Pleiku, because Pleiku was like a heaven sent. Even though we were ordered and, you know, harassed and everything, it was still better than that horrific heat that some of those poor folks on the exterior had to endure. I don't know how they did it. Although they did have air conditioners, most of it. I don't know if they had them in the hooches, because again, we were really isolated. We didn't get to go coerce with everybody, you know. And they didn't let us just jump on an airplane and go somewhere. Mm-hmm. You left when you went for your R&R, you left when you went for leave, and that was it. And you're, you know, stateside. Unless you got injured.
Mm-hmm. Was there a part that you think it was worse? First part of it. Didn't you buy
the food? Yeah, it could be maybe the not knowing a lot of things. They would keep us in the loop. You know, we were never really informed of what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
The people, very honestly, didn't really want us there for the most part. There was a few, but they were always... they were so desperate for anything, you know, the Mamasans. So they'd be your friend anyway. You know, why not? They saw money, you know, hand out. I feel so bad about this one lady that had all her money stolen the last day she was there. I can't believe that that would happen, nor was she smart to keep it. You know, we had to put it in the bank. A good thing that came out of it was that we put all our money in a bank. When we came home, we had actually purchased the car, completely bought it, you know. It was... we've never done that again. But we had a brand new town country station wagon that we bought. And we had enough money saved up that we could put the down payment on a home, and was able to own a home. So, you know, that was a plus, I thought, you know, for being there, because we got combat pay. My husband was really good with the money. We just pooled our money, and it just went into our fund, but it went home. It didn't stay there. We had not that much to spend our money on. I mean, we had a PX that was less than a 7-Eleven, and there wasn't a lot of need that we had, you know, because you had your own, you didn't have to pay for your quarters, and you didn't have to pay for your meals. Although you would willingly go pay at the Air Force just to have something to eat, you know, we didn't have to pay there. And that wasn't a big deal, because it was like, oh my gosh, we have somewhere we can spend some money. So there was nothing really to spend money on. So that was an advantage to us, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And will we do it again? I think I would. You know, I really think that what we did there for humanity was what we were there for. If I had to go and do what the poor guys in the trenches did, there was no way. I mean, to have your buddy that's sitting right next to you get blown to bits and his head rolled down a hill, as we've heard a lot of folks, I don't think we'd ever be the same. So post-traumatic stress, yeah, for that. The way we were treated, you know, there were some inequities, I thought. But for the most part, I think it depends on your connection with your Creator. You know, if you have a real strong belief that you are being cared for and watched over and you're doing what you're supposed to do on this planet, which I had. I'm not saying that protected me, but I am saying I had a faith that, you know, I was there, and I was there for a reason. If I died, so be it, because this was what I was born to do. And I hope that, you know, some of those poor people in Iraq have that same strong belief system. And I don't care what religion people have, you know, being in the kind of, belief system I have, somebody should have some kind of faith. To have, there's nothing there after we leave, there's, you know, there's this big gap, there's nobody watching over us. I don't know. I don't think I could have survived it if I didn't have that belief system. And I did. And I've heard that from the POWs too, where they said that they have that religion or that faith that kept them stable and able to keep going. So I thank God for that. And I also thank my husband, because, you know, he's been my other support system. And right now, you know, he's going through his struggles, so he'll be right as he has his side to hopefully pull him out of bed if I have to. And hopefully we'll find some answers for him. I wish he could get a job. It would be, although, geez, the poor guy's 62. He might be ready for his retirement. But I see people retire and then they die. So the idea of retirement doesn't seem to be in my consciousness. I've got too many things to do yet.
Was there anything we didn't talk about that you wanted to talk about?
Oh, probably. It'll probably come back later. And there's forms here, right, to fill out and to expand on. My children, I will say my children are, and my grandchildren. I have both grandchildren, I believe, are damaged, again, from the chemical. And my husband and I both, you know, handing it down to them, I think made it stronger on both. And we have bona fide immune system defaults, we can show, you know. But the VA doesn't really... I think it's probably money. You know, I would look at it as a research project. Just to say, this is what kinds of things that a dioxin can do to people. And it can create bad things. And can you overcome them? I think you can moderate them. I don't think you'll ever overcome them. And to be able to have, you know, just the mere fact of throwing your hormones off as a woman. And as a man, I think men are going through menopause, and there's going to be a big insurgence of that awareness soon. We're more aware of it now in our, you know, kind of therapies, but these poor guys are going through a lot of hell as well. I mean, how many people have dumped their wives and gone on to other wives and more wives, and they're not finding their bliss, which is sad. You know, and what is bliss? For me, bliss is going out and feeding the animals and shoveling the manure and hugging my horse and milking the goat, you know, and that's my bliss. But what is everybody else's bliss? You know, are they doing their work that they're supposed to do here on the planet while they're here? Because it's pretty short. Mm-hmm. When you look at it, you know, at your age, and you think, oh, that's 60 years old, that's an old person. And now I look at it and I go, I have a lot of life yet. I have a lot of things I got to do yet. And I'm hoping people have that feeling. But I've also met people my age, and they're saying, oh, I'm so old. It's like, wait a minute, you're not old. It's up here. No, it's in your brain. So that's probably one of the statements I want to make. But my children I'm concerned about. My grandchildren I'm even more concerned about. The older one is 5, brilliant, just a brilliant kid. Thank God she doesn't have the dyslexia we have. In fact, she just won in her school Best Artist.
as a kindergartner. And she got a $50 gift certificate and some other awards, and it's like, whoa. Plus she's got a photographic memory. She can read a book and she knows what she read. So she's got a beautiful future if her body will let her. She was also inability to thrive. She wouldn't eat. She's like anorexic. I mean, this is at birth. We're talking teeny little baby, not wanting to eat. She wouldn't eat pavlov. She wouldn't eat applesauce, any texture. She wouldn't eat. She would eat rice. I thought, what do you, did you get some of the Vietnam, you know? Love for rice or what? Where my brother-in-law will never eat rice. He sees rice and it brings back really bad memories. He sees a fly and he goes nuts. And he was over there, that was interesting, at the same time that we were, I think we overlapped, my brother was also over there at the same time. And my poor sister was absolutely fanatically nuts, anti-war. Uh-huh. In fact, I felt so bad because she was down in Washington in the parade when they had that big parade and anti-war demonstrating. Mm-hmm. I thought, how can you do that? And, you know, I understand her now. It was very cool because we had the Vietnam Women in Vietnam Memorial, and she came with us. This was really cool. And my brother's wife at the time knew nothing about Vietnam. And we all went down together. And when we did the march and everything else, the awareness was that I knew why she had protested. I couldn't understand it while I was over in Vietnam, but I understood, you know, she had her brother and her sister over there. And we were getting nowhere. It seemed like an endless circle of nowhere. And she was protesting the idea that she had to possibly lose both of us. So I guess I could understand her viewpoint, and then she came and listened to us and kind of understood our viewpoint, so there was a big healing because of that moment, you know, in time, so that was good. But I think that was one thing that bothered us a lot. And then, of course, I have no problem. When I came back, everybody was saying they got spit on and that kind of thing. We never had any of that, so we lucked out. Everybody that had heard that I was in Vietnam as a nurse, and some of my nursing buddies and that kind of thing wanted us to actually talk about it. Maybe that's why we had the healing we had. Because I have slides that I used to show to the Nurses Association, that kind of thing. I actually was president of the Holistic Nurses Association over in Hawaii for a few years and had them become aware of, you know, the situations, et cetera, too. And I guess gaining understanding causes you to heal as well on both sides. So that might be something. And I'm not at all, obviously, without words to tell people that, you know, this is something that happened. It's over. Put it behind you. And then get out and do what we're supposed to do, is help the enemy. And it still doesn't matter. One of my friends is not going to be in nursing anymore. She's trying to find something else. And I think about it, and it's like, okay, well, she needs to find her mission, whatever it is next. Mm-hmm. But at least she needs to do something, not just sit there for me. You know, I've been through this experience, and I can't get over it. Mm-hmm. You know, we're here for a purpose, and obviously some of the folks that survived and lost legs and that kind of thing, I see that all the time at the VA. I feel like, wow, you know, I am so lucky. I'm not going to complain. And sometimes I should pursue some of my other ailments, but it's like, no, they need more than I do. I'll still go and, you know, be part of their guinea pig experiments if they want. But I sure would like to get some other awareness that there are some other things that they can do to have a quality life. And I'm not saying I achieved the, you know, optimum life, but I'd like to be able to not work as hard as I have to work to gain a living, but I make a good living in what I do. And that's only because I know I'm doing the right path that I'm supposed to be doing. Never in my life would I ever have thought I'd make as much money as I do an hour. And I can support my husband and I, and sometimes my kids when they're falling on their face, like my son just lost his job. And that just blows my mind that I can carry the whole ball as bad as I sometimes feel. Because there are waves of, this is a bad time. My liver is kicking me again. So I don't think you're ever cured, but I think you can moderate it. So I don't have a final statement except thank you. Thank you for for doing this interview, and I hope that we gather a lot of data this weekend and get to see some old things.
Yeah. All right, well, we'll end the interview.